Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. When the natural world is changing faster than we can make sense of it, where do we look for hope? Not the wishful kind, but the kind that's grounded in what's actually out there. Today, we're talking to a wildlife biologist and author with years of firsthand experience in some of the most remote places who has been asking exactly that question and finding some unexpected answers. That's ahead on today's Outdoor Explorer. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein, and today my guest is Caroline Van Hemert. Caroline is an Alaskan author, biologist, and adventurer whose work has taken her all over the world. Caroline has been a previous guest on this show in 2019 after her book, The Sun is a Compass, was published. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer, Caroline.
Thanks so much for having me, Martha. I'm really excited to be here.
Thanks. So first, really, you know, easy, brief question. Can you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I'm trained as a biologist, so that's kind of been my day job for many years. And more recently, I've been spending a lot of my time writing as well. So I'm actually writing full time now. I've taken a little hiatus from research. And then kind of the third hat I wear often is as an adventurer. And over the last, I guess, decade plus, that's involved adventuring with a family. So I have two children, two sons who are currently 9 and 11. So a lot of our travels have been with them.
So the last time you were on this show, you were talking mostly about your book, which covers a 4,000 mile trip you took from Bellingham, Washington to Kotzebue, Alaska. And for those who aren't familiar with your work, can you tell us just a little bit more about that trip and the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the Sun is a Compass is based on, as you mentioned, a kind of a long backcountry journey. So this was pre-kids. Probably wouldn't have worked in the same fashion as parents. I had just finished up my PhD in biology, studying birds in Alaska primarily. And we started down in Bellingham with rowboats, hand-built rowboats that my husband, Pat, built in a friend and neighbor's garage. And took us up the Inside Passage where we left our rowboats near Haines, where we have a place that we've built off grid, went up and over the mountains by ski and pack raft, then eventually made our way kind of overland and into the headwaters of the Mackenzie River, came out the Arctic coast, traveled along the Arctic coast, and then essentially a traverse of the Brooks Range. So it was about a 6-month expedition that covered, like you said, about 4,000 miles, all human powered travel. And I guess the point of that in the context of the book is that that journey sort of gave me the impetus and the motivation to work on a book length project and to really dig back into my roots as a writer, which I have a background in, but hadn't really done more professionally until this larger project.
Did the book come out of the trip, or were you like, oh, I'm going to do this trip and write a book about it? Or was it sort of the book evolved from the adventure?
Yeah, the latter part. The book evolved from the adventure. So I didn't set out to write a book, nor did I really know how to do that. I have a master's of creative writing that I had done a number of years before, but I kind of, dipped really deeply into that world and then stepped out and went back to school for biology and had been doing field work kind of that whole time. And so I had never taken on anything of nearly that scale. And after doing the trip, I think there were so many experiences and so many things that I'd kind of learned along the way that it did inspire me to write. And it felt like something large enough that I could think about translating it into a book. But it's more than just a travelogue. It's kind of a coming of age story for me as a biologist. And I realized this later, but it's a bit of a love story between my husband, Pat, and I, and how we came to really find ourselves both independently and together in the outdoors. It's also about birds more than anything, probably. Sorry, I forgot the main characters.
I did. I really enjoyed that book a lot. And that was part of the reason when I heard you were writing a new book, that was part of the reason why I wanted to talk with you. So like all good adventurers, you and your family have been on another big adventure. You sailed 5,000 miles from, I think, Greece to the Arctic. How did that trip evolve and how did it come to be?
Yeah, good question. So I think maybe when our kids were about, I want to say 18 months and not quite 4, we had done a number of backcountry adventures with young children. And for any parents out there with babies or now maybe bigger kids, you know that that's not always a simple endeavor. And we got to the point where hauling everything on our backs and having 2 kids who could both walk and yet weren't that mobile. We were trying to get a little bit more creative with how we could still get to do some of the adventures, but more importantly, get to some of the places that we really deeply love, which tend to be a little bit off the beaten track. And so that's where a sailboat came into play. And my husband Pat and I had actually lived on a sailboat in Bellingham, Washington, many years before, kind of as a, I don't know, an alternative source of cheap housing, as Pat was in his undergraduate and I was doing my creative writing master's program at the time, and had enjoyed sailing but never got really, really into it. But with kids, it seemed like, oh, here's an opportunity to have a floating home base and to get to some wild places and maybe get to travel without having to carry all of it on our backs. So that's kind of the long version of how a boat came into our lives. And that was actually a smaller boat that we had based in Haines, Alaska. And we initially sailed up the Inside Passage. So from Washington up to Southeast Alaska and then did a number of trips off of that. And I think, parts of it worked really well. And of course, other parts you can imagine, like sailing with diapers and babies and all the things that make those adventures fun and also very challenging. But it was enough to sort of spur the possibility of where else we could go and how we could maybe go bigger. And as the kids got a little bit older and became more capable themselves, we started to dream a bit larger. And so we ended up kind of throwing ourselves at this bigger project, which eventually involved sailing back home to Alaska, but we started in the Mediterranean, which feels like couldn't be more different for me as a born and bred Alaskan, in terms of, yeah, just everything about it. But we started there, and over the course of about 2 years, we made our way out of the Mediterranean up across the Bay of Biscay, for those of you who know that part of the world, but essentially up to the UK, into Norway, over to Iceland, to the east coast of Greenland and around Greenland, and then eventually sailed home through the Northwest Passage. And the boat now is back home in South Central Alaska in Homer.
Okay. For those who don't know about the Northwest Passage, it's kind of one of the most storied and challenging routes in the maritime world. What makes it so challenging and what was your experience sailing through it?
Yeah, so I think, I don't know if this is, I should probably not cite this statistic because I am not prepared to back it up as a good scientist, but I've heard repeatedly that many more people have climbed Mount Everest than sailed through the Northwest Passage. So it is
Wow.
kind of the upper echelon of high latitude sailing. And part of what makes it really challenging is the season. It's incredibly short and largely because of ice. So sea ice has historically blocked that passage and made it very difficult. And at times people have been stuck in the ice, and there's all kinds of wild stories and adventures over the decades and centuries of trying to go through the Northwest Passage, and it doesn't always work. And so on the one hand, things have become more open, like the water is more open now than it was because of sea ice melt and just generally, climate warming. But at the same time, conditions are more variable, so it's not a sure bet. So just a handful of years ago, no boats made it through because some of the ice that is blocking the passages is multi-year ice. It's breaking off and showing up in different places than historically. So like a lot of climate related changes, it's also much more variable than it was in previous years. So all that to say that there's still plenty of challenges to be had. Some of the storms that are hitting that Arctic coast now are much, much bigger. We had one experience with a really fierce blow up there that I think was considered like a once in a century event, but of course those are becoming increasingly common as well. But yeah, so essentially the Northwest Passage, looser definition, is coming from that eastern side of Canada across the top of North America, and then eventually wrapping down and around into the Chukchi Sea, the Bering Sea, and I mean the kind of the Northwest Passage itself ends somewhere in those waters. But for us, it meant sailing all the way back through the Aleutians and to South Central Alaska.
What was the logistics of like having to deal with this was a multi-year trip, and you're as you said, crossing from, the Mediterranean, which is a very different climate than the Northwest Passage and even the Aleutians. How do you manage all of that when you're not necessarily like you're at sea for a while, you don't have the ability to just pop ashore and get some supplies for the changing weather? How do you prepare for something that long and that varied?
Yeah, so I think the being prepared is probably, a huge piece, particularly when you venture into Arctic waters, because I think no one goes into the Northwest Passage with any certainty that they're going to end up where they think they are. And I think that's a good rule of sailing in general, is that, schedules and destinations don't usually merge very well with any kind of adventure sailing, because you're all at, the whims of the weather and the conditions and the mechanics of your boat and all those things. But yeah, so we had the luxury, I guess, of space, like as compared to a backcountry trip where you're carrying everything on your back or hauling it in a sled. There is an element of luxury just in the fact that you can pack more on board. Of course, sailboats aren't, at least ours is not huge by any means. So it's kind of a matter of squirreling everything away, and it always feels like you could use more space. But I think having all the spare parts on board and sourcing those, often, through complicated logistics, is one element of it. And then just the different kinds of gear for, like you said, that you're going from swimming in shorts and a bathing suit, or we had skis on board for a lot of it because we were skiing when we were in those more Arctic areas and high latitudes. We had kind of like what you would wear in the middle of winter in Alaska, and just about every kind of configuration of clothing and gear that you might need. And so having that all on board and making sure that you set off with what you need from the beginning. Food is another big one. I have two boys who eat a lot, so making sure we were well supplied in that realm. And it often meant, if we were in port somewhere, we would just do massive dinghy shuttles of groceries back and forth, loading up on everything we could, so that when we were somewhere where there wasn't a grocery store, which was more often than not, that we had what we needed on board. And we did, I guess it's, when you leave from Eastern Canada or even Greenland all the way more or less home to Alaska, there aren't any big communities to stop in, and they're grocery stores, but they're pretty few and far between. And of course, you don't want to show up and clear out all the shelves of a small community that has
Right.
only a barge or a helicopter or an airplane supplying it every so often. So we did try to come as prepared as we could on that front too. But yeah, so it's kind of a lots of logistics and lots of planning in advance, but
Yeah.
also being willing to pivot when you need to, both in terms of route and what you have at hand, and things break and things go wrong. And so the expectation of a good adventure is being ready to change course.
Yeah. So, what do you think that your, what do you hope that your sons took away from this experience? This is kind of like an experience that probably, I don't know, fewer people than have gone through the Northwest Passage have experienced the full your full journey of 5,000 miles in a boat at a young age. What do you hope that they took away from that or will carry with them into the rest of their lives?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think some of it is just the appreciation of being in the natural world and, maybe being a visitor to places and in that sense of, you show up somewhere and you don't know how things work. And the kindness of strangers, I can't overstate how much we all took away from the experience that just getting to know people often in a situation where you're asking maybe not favors, but you're coming and you're ultimately a bit vulnerable and opening ourselves up to, yeah, just having new interactions and new friendships. My younger son, he loves to go fishing, and every port that we stopped in, he would always make new friends, whether they were, same age kids or younger or much, much older than him. But that was kind of the common language that even if they weren't able to communicate through words, it seemed like, there's always a grandfatherly type or a fellow kid who wants to show them the tips of their local water. So I think some of those points for our kids were really neat and for me to see as well. And also that sense, like you were describing, of preparation, but also being able to, when something goes wrong, you got to figure out what you're going to do about it, not just sort of throw in the towel and say, oh, well, that didn't work. So I think they learned a lot in terms of like how to fix things and yeah, even being open-minded to a whole range of different solutions, or at least I hope they did. I know I did.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, this is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein, and I'm talking to author and wildlife biologist Caroline Van Hemert about her recent sailing adventure with her family and the new book she's in the process of writing. You've said that in one of the interviews that I read in preparing for this, you said that the writing process is more complex than something like a 4,000-mile expedition, which might sound surprising to some people, but I don't think it sounds surprising. The expedition just requires staying alive, but writing a book requires generating and organizing ideas and then making sure that people actually care about them. When you add a 43-foot boat and two kids into the mix, is writing a book still harder, or is the expedition more challenging?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm kind of in the throes of working on the book project right now, so I would say that's much harder. At least it's the, when you're in it, everything is so immediate to the day-to-day that there's a level of immersion that I wouldn't say it makes it easier, but it does sort of force that sense of being present. And I mean, that's something that kids have always brought for me, as does the natural world and, being outside, and whether you're, watching chickadees in your backyard or dealing with a storm on a glacier, there's just a level of immediacy, I think, that we don't always have the luxury of experiencing, especially in our current context where there's just so much happening all the time and so much input. So I would say that part of the journey itself was easier, or at least, more. The rewards and the consequences and all those are much more direct, whereas writing, as you described, can, there's a lot of organizational logistics that need to happen, but you don't always know exactly what you're preparing for. At least that's my experience as a writer, that writing is such an exploratory process in its own right, and I think that can be really fun and exciting, and it also can feel utterly overwhelming and feel very lost at sea, as cliche as that sounds. But yeah, so I would still say I'm landing on the side of writing being harder, and just because I wrote one book doesn't make this project any easier or more straightforward.
Yeah, I just had a conversation with a friend who I went on like a cabin trip with, and people asked her, "Well, what are you gonna do?" And she's like, "Oh, what do you mean? What am I gonna do? Like, there's plenty to be done. You know, you gotta start the fire, and then you gotta cook, and you gotta boil water. You know, there's so many when you're out surviving. You know, there's so many things that are just like you said, right in front of you that you have to do just to sort of keep yourself going, and it fills time in a way that is very different than our modern lives, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And those little moments of reward too, and that sense of the unexpected, really makes those experiences when you're out figuring things out so much more kind of rich. And yeah, you just can't get stuck in a rut because there's always, something is going to surprise you. Or I think of our encounters with wildlife just in many of the weeks that we spent in the Northwest Passage and then further south. And we had a couple of polar bears come swim up to our boat and check us out. We got to sail alongside bowhead whales. There's just so many moments where kind of puts you outside of yourself. And I hope that that's another thing that the kids took away from it, is just that sense of the world being a lot larger than our own little insular experience of it, that there's all of these things happening in our presence all the time, whether we see them or know anything about them or not. So that
Yeah.
to me is always a really powerful.
Your Instagram feed from this trip has a little bit a glimpse of the Bering Sea during the typhoon that happened, which caused, devastating flooding in coastal Alaska communities. What was it like to witness that kind of storm from the water and then to see kind of the aftermath of that on land?
Well, thankfully, we were not in the Bering Sea when that storm system rolled through. We were tied up in harbor at Sandpoint when a lot of that was unfolding, and then, subsequently. So I can only say how incredibly grateful we were to be out of sort of the path of that, but also how recognizing how devastating those kinds of winds and water events can be. We had spent several days kind of weathering out a storm up on the Arctic coast. So on the Canadian side near the Edmonton Gulf, we had actually just spent a couple of days sort of weaving through. It was actually several days weaving through this really thick multi-year pack ice, and spent one very memorable night actually in the ice, sort of floating among these massive floes. And we was dark by that time, because it's already, getting to be August and into September by the time those waters tend to be open. So we spent a night in the ice, feeling quite vulnerable. And fortunately, we didn't have wind at the same time. But I remember maybe 2, 3 in the morning, my husband Pat and I were on watch. Of course, you don't just go to sleep when you're dealing with those conditions. That's another big challenge of sailing, is there's a lot of time of being awake and not always a lot of opportunity to sleep. But we were up on deck, kind of steering, trying to avoid running into any of these really large flows. And the northern lights started to come out, which always, gives you a little bit of a sense of like, okay, I have a little bit of wonder and awe, at least to buffer this stress. And then a flock of snow geese, I could just hear them from a distance. And then as they came closer and closer, they flew right overhead. And it was one of those moments where I'm like, okay, I think things are going to be okay. And it turned out that about 24 hours later, we were in what we thought was safe harbor. It's a place called Summers Harbor, which probably aptly named, because it's a lot more pleasant in the summer, although we were there arguably in the summer. But we showed up, and the whole bay was lined with these massive flows of ice, which was not what we wanted to see, because we knew a big storm was coming. And the idea was to hunker down there and wait it out. And we basically spent the next 72 hours kind of dodging these huge flows of ice. And we had winds that exceeded 70, 75 miles an hour. And it was the same storm that hit that Canadian coast, and Tuktoyaktuk got hit very hard, and they had a lot of storm surge and flooding. So that was a more sort of direct connection that we had with a community that was impacted kind of from this different storm, but it was one of the biggest storms that had hit that coastline, to my knowledge, at least in the last 100 years. And so as we were moving through the Northwest Passage, I think sailors maybe who had come from other places and didn't appreciate the fierceness of the Bering Sea, or that whole region, the Gulf of Alaska in the fall, were kind of like, oh, we more or less made it. You just have to get to know them and then you're good. But in some ways, we were most apprehensive about that next section, just knowing. I mean, I worked up there, and yeah, I've been in Alaska my whole life, so I appreciate the ferocity of storms, and particularly, in recent years, they've been getting bigger and less predictable in terms of their seasonality. So going through the Bering Sea, we were fortunate to have pretty settled weather, but throughout it, in the backs of our minds, was just this constant sense of urgency and having to hurry, because waiting in the fall there is not a place you want to be stuck. And obviously for, communities that had nowhere to go, yeah, that recent Typhoon Heilong was clearly devastating. And I can't imagine being out there in a boat in something like that.
Shifting a little bit more towards your work as like your field research and your work as a biologist. So you're also, in addition to being a writer and adventurer, you're a wildlife biologist with a PhD. How does your scientific work weave into your adventures? I think anybody who's read your book probably knows the answer how this works, but just how does that work for you?
Yeah, so it's I think it's basically I kind of grew up as a scientist doing field work in lots of remote places in Alaska and really fell in love with both rediscovering kind of my outdoor roots. I was a bit of a reluctant adventurer as a kid, as my parents can attest. I really loved to be sitting on a couch with a book. That was adventure enough for me. But as I got into college and started to do more field biology, I really, really fell in love with both science and ecology and ornithology, but also that sense of being out and getting to see some of these things up close and personal. And so I would say that many of my sort of adventure routes are tied closely to my scientific work, but there's a practicality too in the difference between doing science and being out, covering miles or doing journeys that are sort of self-directed. And so at some point they started to diverge a little bit. And so the big 4,000-mile journey that we took was almost a response to me having spent so much time in the laboratory, kind of cooped up with the rigidity, I guess, of science. And so it was like an answer to remembering why I got into the field in the first place. And I would say there's a lot of that happening in more current adventures too. So the sailing and other backcountry trips that we've taken, where, yeah, it's not that it's an anti-science move, but it does allow me to sort of see the natural world more on my terms without the bounds, I guess, that come with you're doing an experiment or you're, asking these very specific questions. So yeah, I think they complement each other, but they don't always look the same, if that makes sense.
Birds, you've mentioned birds are something that you love. They show up kind of at the center of much of what you do. What is it about birds specifically that sort of drew you in, not mammals or fish or other natural things that you might study in biology?
Yeah, I mean, I do like all those other things too. And actually, I'm
Yeah, of
sort of in
course.
this current book project, I'm getting to rediscover a little bit, like step outside of my own expertise, which is really
Great.
fun. And that's part of what the writing challenges me to do, I think, is to know more than what I know, or to learn more than what I currently think I know. But yeah, I think birds, I mean, in part it was because those were some of my first field experiences. I spent one of my very first field seasons was in Chute Bay in Prince William Sound, just not too far outside of Valdez, and at this seabird colony. So it was black-legged kittiwakes, and essentially like living in the company of 10,000 birds, I think had a really fundamental impact on me. I also had an early professor at the University of Arizona who was obsessed with birds, and he actually was one of the experts, and much of his work continues to be kind of the foundational work that we have on Rufous hummingbirds. And so I think, yeah, sort of as a 19-year-old being, very apt to be influenced by others' passions, that some of the time that I spent in the Sonoran Desert chasing around these amazing sort of southern latitude birds also influenced. I realize more and more now how I think about biology and science and conservation, really. It was a conservation biology class, but much of it centered on birds.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm Martha Rosenstein. After this break, we'll continue speaking to Caroline Van Hemert on what the natural world can teach us about hope and the book that she's writing about it.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein, and I'm speaking with author and wildlife biologist Caroline Van Hemert about her new book and the adventures that inspired it.
You recently, or not recently, I guess it was 2019, wrote a piece in Hakai magazine, which won the Banff Mountain Article Award. It's about peregrine falcons in Greenland. You wrote about those birds as part of your voyage, your sailing voyage. How did that story find you?
Yeah, great question. So it was in 2025. So it was when
it was recently.
Sort of, yep, it was pretty recent. It was part of this when we sailed over to Greenland. You know, it came about actually a colleague who is a raptor biologist, and I had been working with him on one of my research projects, specifically looking at beak deformities in birds, which was kind of what my graduate work was on, and then it's since morphed into lots of other species and broader questions. And so I was communicating with him about beak deformities in hawks and red-tailed hawks. So nowhere near Greenland, nothing to do with peregrines. But I, you know, mentioned that this we were planning to take this sailing journey. And he said, oh, yeah, well, some of my buddies worked in Greenland many years ago. They got their sort of roots in peregrines. And it sparked something in me because I didn't really associate peregrines with Greenland, or sort of, I mean, I knew peregrines from the northern Alaskan coast, so I'd certainly seen them up there, but it just sparked this curiosity. And so I started to dig a little bit into what's peregrine research in Greenland all about and what relevance does it have to what's going on today. And I found this story that was much richer than I could have imagined, in part because the birds themselves are so remarkable. Peregrine falcons will literally nest at the ends of the earth almost everywhere you can imagine. And they're so incredibly adaptable and resilient. And so there's kind of an element of that, of course, tied to the fact that at one point they were, you know, teetering on extinction, not due to the same challenges they're facing now, but because of pesticides, DDT, and others that influenced the health of so many different bird species, including peregrine falcons. And so it's sort of this story of redemption and resilience and really wild, fun, quirky researchers who have themselves gone to the ends of the earth to chase peregrines. And so, yeah, I found all these fun links, and then getting the chance to experience that in person by actually sailing into these fjords, seeing peregrine falcons there for me the first time with my boys, and then kind of becoming almost like a peregrine fangirl, I think, as I framed it as a result.
I think that's a great example of how your kind of science brain and your writer brain mix, you know, that scientific curiosity, and then it turned into a great story.
Yeah. I love those. It is often, you know, I'll be reading briefings in whatever journal notice I'm getting, or talking to a colleague, or thinking about something, some nerdy science piece, but then how that sort of translates into the world more broadly, and how that makes me think about myself and humans in general. Those are the questions I get most excited about, is that interface between, like you said, sort of the science, the personal, and that what that means for all of us.
My understanding also is that the peregrines in Greenland are actually very distinct and not fully understood, like that population is still different. What does that tell us about, what does that population tell us about resilience and change in the Arctic?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the big things about peregrines is that they are so incredibly opportunistic when it comes to nesting sites, when it comes to what they eat. So, you know, we might think of them in cities as chomping on pigeons, or, you know, these urban sort of sources of food. In Greenland, as they're pushing farther and farther north, they're eating seabirds and, sort of things that we wouldn't necessarily think about as a normal peregrine diet. I think the story is kind of two-sided, because on the one hand, peregrines are incredibly resilient, and this Greenlandic population in particular is showing what's possible. There's other species that are more Arctic specialists, like ger falcons come to mind. And there's a little bit of tension there, because some species don't have that ability to push farther and to necessarily, you know, be quite so generalist in what they do. So the peregrines themselves offer the sort of story of I don't want to say like too cheesy, hope and resilience, but a bit of that, you know, they're kind of making it despite the odds in some places. But then other species, you know, it's not as clear what their trajectory is, because they have much more specific needs and demands. So some of the researchers that were working on peregrines in Greenland are also interested in, you know, what that means for ger falcons, which are according to them, much more timid, and that the peregrines tend to be almost like bullies a bit, which is probably part of why they do so well. They're really yeah. scrappy birds, and you kind of have to love them for that. But yeah, there's always you know, two sides of any of those stories, of course.
So we know, because we live in Alaska, that the Arctic is changing faster than pretty much anywhere else on the planet. And you have your home in Haines is near the Davidson Glacier on the Lynn Canal. Is that correct?
Correct.
And like most glaciers, that's changing very visibly and very rapidly. What is it like to watch something like that from your doorstep over the years, both as a scientist and as a human living on this planet?
Yeah, it's very sobering. And actually, the book that I'm working on now is a bit of a response, not specifically to the Davidson Glacier, but to just witnessing that change. So I got into the field of wildlife biology, kind of that starry-eyed 19-year-old loving the natural world and being so excited about its possibilities. And then as my work progressed, I got a lot more into wildlife health and was dealing with these massive mortality events, so these big die-offs of birds and other species. And so I started to become almost like a wildlife health detective, which is intellectually fascinating and also can be really psychically disorienting, in the sense that, you know, I have at that time, two young children, and I'm trying to explain to them why, you know, these birds are never going to fly away. And, you know, death itself is, of course, part of life. So that wasn't so much the problem, but just the scale of changes that we're seeing. And something like the Davidson Glacier in our backyard is such a visible marker of that. But the book I'm working on right now, it's kind of a wildlife biologist and mother's response to what's a narrative that we can create for, you know, our children, but also for ourselves, that isn't just one of kind of catastrophe and doom, because of course that isn't a tenable sort of philosophy moving forward. And I think we're all probably overwhelmed. I mean, even as a scientist or working in this field of climate change and wildlife health, at some point, you can only take so much of the bad news. So where do we look for sort of alternatives? And not to say that, you know, we're deluding ourselves by making things up, but just, are there examples of possibility and resilience and, you know, different surprise endings than that the main sort of, I guess, story that we've all been hearing for so long, that we're essentially doomed? Yeah, what else is out there and how else can we think about it? And in turn, how can the natural world help us think more broadly about, you know, our own possibilities and our own behavior?
So let's talk a little bit about your new book project. The book is tentatively titled, maybe it's since I've read that, it's now not tentative anymore, but titled Upwellings. Where does that title come from?
Yeah, good question. So it comes actually from a very specific moment or experience when I was sitting at the cabin in Lynn Canal, looking out the window. I think it was in February, and we were having this massive north gale, which is not uncommon there in the winter. But there's a lighthouse not too far from our cabin, and I think it was registering 70 plus miles per hour. So just a, you know, fierce, fierce blow. And I started seeing a handful of gulls beating into it. So these glaucous wing gulls, some people might be familiar with, they're almost like trash birds or dump birds. We might think of them primarily, but I first got to know them when I was working in Chute Bay on the black-legged kittiwake colony, and the glaucous wing gulls would nest at the top, and they were always harassing the birds, and they'd be coming back from the dump with full hot dogs or all sorts of gross things. So I didn't have like a real affinity for them initially, but I was really impressed to see these birds just like beating into a headwind and trying to figure out what they were doing. And, you know, first it was a handful, then it was dozens, then it turned out to be hundreds and more over the course of the morning and then throughout the day. And I couldn't figure out if they just all had a really terrible idea or if there was some root for this behavior. And it took a while of watching them and trying to understand, asking questions, and it kind of got an answer through a circuitous means via a colleague, but that there was an old eBird report from several years before that sort of tracked the same phenomenon. And essentially what's going on is these birds, they know somehow scattered hundreds, if not more miles away in the winter, that when you get these strong offshore wind events, it essentially pushes the surface of the water away and allows the deep water to flow up. So it creates essentially an upwelling. So it's kind of this like feast for all these birds as they're, you know, seemingly suicidal on the wind, just like, you know, beating into this crazy cold wind. But they know that if they work hard enough and sort of have this deferred reward, that they're going to show up and have more food than they could possibly imagine. So I think at times at the head of Lynn Canal, there'll be gatherings of 10,000 birds or more that are, you know, for people who know gulls, you know that they're very dispersed in the winter. They can be, spread out over hundreds of miles, but they somehow all are picking up on these cues from so far distant and then converging on this massive food source. So it sort of like sparks something in my mind that, you know, animals know things, of course, that we can only hope to. And this idea of like, why animals make decisions based on deferred rewards that often we have a much harder time doing. So sort of opened up these questions. And then the upwellings piece also speaks to these specific encounters I've had, not just with the gulls, but, you know, with bowhead whales, with having a hummingbird in my hand, with sea sponges, some of these critters that I wouldn't normally think of as that remarkable, and kind of opening up all these questions about the resilience of the natural world and what that means for our own future.
How did the structure of this book evolve? So you've got these, like, you know, you start with a specific species and expand it into bigger questions about climate and our relationship with the world. How did that structure come to be?
I think it kind of came to be in the same way that some of these ideas were filtering in. I felt very overwhelmed. I felt really unsure how to make sense of, you know, this narrative of doom and gloom that we're all facing. And my work just exacerbated that, really. And so, you know, it's kind of when I felt like at my lowest in terms of, like, as a scientist or as a mother, and I had no answers for my kids when they're like, oh, why, you know, why is the glacier going away? What's happening with the polar bears? All those things that young kids are, you know, they're not afraid to ask, I guess. And as we get older, sometimes we shy away from those questions a bit more. But I think the structure came because I would get these little sparks in really unexpected ways, kind of what we were talking about earlier, how part of that beauty of being in the natural world, being on an adventure, being with young children, is that you just don't know what you're going to find or how it's going to find you. So that the kind of chaotic nature of finding these like sparks and connections in turn lent itself to the structure itself, which is, you know, hopefully over the course of the book, sort of evolving to some, I don't want to say answers, but some new revelations, but in not in such a like journey fashion. So it isn't starting at one place and arriving somewhere else, but instead, so I think letting the organic elements of the natural world really complement the book structure has been, the way that I've been approaching the writing process too.
Kind of you, so you mentioned that narrative of doom and gloom, and this project is kind of an, you know, way to not think into that as much around climate change and solutions and all of that. Can you share an example or two of how you continue to find wonder in things like melting permafrost and irreversible loss of wildlife in their habitat?
Yeah, so it's not always all sort of rosy optimism by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think that the capacity of animals to learn and to behave in ways that sort of offer these unexpected ends. So, you know, one case of that was we were in Glacier Bay. This was, I think, in 2020, 2021. We were in Glacier Bay on a sailboat. This was kind of pre-Northwest Passage trip. And we were, we came upon this dead wolf pup. And it was actually on my birthday. It was one of those things where you think, oh, wow, this is so depressing. I have, you know, young kids. We're trying to make sense of this life that was interrupted, presumably, you know, before you'd like to see it turn into a grown wolf. And, you know, my initial response to it was a bit of sadness and also just the sense of like, okay, well, the whole world is kind of falling apart right now. Here's just another example of something gone wrong. And it pushed me then to think and learn more about wolves, and there's a population in Glacier Bay on Pleasant Island that has sort of turned over how we think about how wolves deal with predator-prey dynamics. So they've learned to capitalize on sea otters, and it was this really phenomenal example. A colleague, former colleague Gretchen Roffler, her work and others has shown how this small population of wolves in Alaska has essentially turned on its head how we think about what wolves do and, you know, how, what happens when they come to a place where there aren't any more deer to eat. And it turns out they have more solutions than we maybe initially gave them credit for. There's other examples too of wolf behavior. There was a wolf on Vancouver Island that learn to pull these crab pots, which
Yeah, I
is
read
pretty
about that.
fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this you know, what started probably as just one wolf, and it has in turn spread to who knows how many more. But you know, you watch these wolves pulling in crab pots, kind of, I mean, I can't hand over hand it, but mouth over mouthing it, I guess.
Yeah.
And you know, just like fascinating what animals do, and we often don't give them credit, I think, for what's possible. And then there's, of course, you know, things that are even like brainless sea sponges, their ability to contend with these really massive, massive changes in the environment over evolutionary time. And you look to some of these examples. So I think it's both like the behavioral piece and then looking at what's happened in the past and you know, how critters are sometimes more able to contend with challenges than we might initially think. So it's not all good news, but certainly there are alternative endings to just, yeah, collapse and disaster.
If you're just joining us, this is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein, and I'm talking to author and wildlife biologist Caroline Van Hemert about her recent sailing adventure with her family and the new book she's in the process of writing.
You've written that scientists need to tell their own stories, not just publish their research. And it seems like it sounds like your new book is sort of living at the intersection of that. And I think your previous book certainly had some of that in it. Why do you feel that it is particularly important to hear stories from scientists, not just science from scientists?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're not lacking information or data at this point. And it's not to say that the research isn't a central piece of it, but that in itself, I think we're all recognizing is not enough to motivate change, that, you know, ultimately, we have to step outside of just that inundation of more and more and more in terms of knowledge. And a lot of it is not good news. And so I think we have a tendency, our brains have a tendency to kind of shut down when we have too much of that bad news. And then we just focus on like the micro, and that doesn't always translate into appreciable change. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting social cognitive research and psychological research now too, sort of thinking about how we make decisions and how do we, you know, see other possibilities for ourselves. And so for me as a scientist, I'm especially drawn to those stories that merge, you know, the personal and what we know about the world, and different ways of knowing as well. So I think partially it's just that's what I'm drawn to, but more than anything, I feel like storytelling is our best hope at making change into the future and kind of creating the change that we want to see, because more information is not proving to be more action.
Alaska is different, but people elsewhere, you know, maybe feel a little bit disconnected, or they don't feel a connection quite the same way that we do here to the natural world. So reading stories from people who feel that connection then kind of maybe hopefully sparks that understanding a little bit better for people to actually care about it.
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, I had a lot of experience working with the public as a research scientist, and you know, a lot of it comes back to chickadees, like we said earlier, but sometimes the most passionate, the most sort of action-driven people I spoke to were motivated by the chickadee or chickadees in their backyard. So they make that individual connection for themselves, and it becomes more than just, you know, another dot on a graph, but it's actually a bird that has a story, and that, you know, somehow their story interfaces with. And so, yeah, the lengths that people will go to, I think, when they feel that personal connection, and I hope that's what writing and storytelling ultimately can do, is just offer that point of connection. So it doesn't feel like, yeah, it's just a bunch of scientists, you know, talking heads kind of about esoteric things, but yeah, hopefully bringing that to a more personal means.
Who are the writers who inspire you or who you go back to when you're feeling stuck, either on a piece or just trying to remember why any of this even matters?
Yeah, good question. There's so many wonderful science writers. I really am drawn a lot to children's literature too, actually. When I read aloud to my kids, I realize, you know, everything we need to know about the world is in children's literature. I just think of a couple authors I've been reading with them lately. Catherine Rundell is one. I sometimes turn to poetry if I am kind of in need of a little bit, you know, more remembrance of the language piece that really does draw me to writing in the first place. I've been reading David George Haskell, just recently published a book about flowers. And yeah, so some of the sort of science journalism I really enjoy, but I think my roots stem from books like Terry Tempest Williams' Refuge many, many years ago. I remember reading that at field camp. Barry Lopez, yeah, that sort of like wide-eyed wonder piece of it is often, you know, where I turn. More contemporary books like Lab Girl, I really enjoyed. And yeah, so many good ones out there. And we have so many amazing Alaskan authors too. So I'm always like, there was just recently the Alaska Literary Field Guide, I believe. I'm really excited to check that out. Lots of voices from within Alaska. So yeah, so many, but I would say, yeah, kind of a combination of more of the traditional science journalism and like poetry and children's literature.
Yeah. Shifting gears just a little bit to kind of talk a little bit more about family and home. Your husband, Pat, has been your partner on like every major adventure it seems like you've taken. What does it take to do all of that with the same person?
Yeah. I mean, you know, of course you get to know each other's patterns in the backcountry, but also you come to trust each other very deeply. So I think when we are in, you know, moments where tension is high or stakes are high, we certainly trust each other's judgment. So there's just that very basic understanding. I think for that big trip we did previously, that's the basis of The Sun as a Compass, that sense of shared purpose was so compelling throughout that we never really questioned what we were doing or why we were doing it. I think because we had such a sense of shared purpose. You know, you throw kids into the mix and it complicates those relationships a bit, and there's other people besides just yourselves to worry about. So we've had to renegotiate some of that over time. And I think it is a constantly evolving partnership in the backcountry and, you know, just in life, as anyone who's in a long-term relationship and especially as parents know. So yeah, I think it's evolved into a piece where we really want the kids to feel like they're key members of the crew, that it's their journey as much as it is ours. And, you know, there's times where you have to do things simply because they have to be done and it's not fun. But yeah, I would say that, you know, from the sailing perspective, they saw themselves as integral members of our adventure and as of our crew, which I think is really important whenever you have multiple people involved. So yeah. So it's about Pat and I, but it's also about the family.
Yeah. We talked about your home in Haines. You split your time between Haines and Anchorage and your boat. But it sounds like the cabin on the Lynn Canal seems to be the place that keeps pulling everything kind of in focus to you. It's where the title of the book came from. It sounds like it's where you go to kind of reset. What is it about that place? What does that place give you that nowhere else does? And why does it keep pulling you back?
Definitely our heart home, I would say. So I guess just to maybe explain a little bit, we ended up finding that piece of property in the most improbable way. We were on a kayaking trip from Haines to, we thought we were headed to Juneau, and, you know, we'd seen some flyer in the Haines grocery store that this piece of property was for sale, and we paddled out there thinking, oh, we'll just take a little look as we go. And we basically landed and stopped the rest of the trip and did everything we could to figure out how to make that sort of our home. Totally impractical, continues to be impractical. It's boat access. Lynn Canal is a fierce body of water. There's a lot of days where you're not commuting back and forth, but it was probably, if not the, certainly one of the most certain things I've ever been in my life in terms of a decision. And it's felt that way ever since. There's just this incredible draw. I think the energy of the place, the interface between mountains and water. And we built the cabin from logs on the property. So much of our history is embedded in that experience and in that place. Yeah. So it feels very much like, yeah, our heart home. And fortunately, the boys feel the same way. We're in Anchorage right now, but they want nothing more than to be back at the cabin in the workshop, banging around. The opportunities for wildlife, certainly the community of Haines itself is a huge draw, but we are quite a ways from town. So
I feel like your mention of the impractical, it's impractical, but it's also, you've never questioned it. I feel like that sums up a lot of things about both you and that seems to be true for a lot of people in a lot of ways, right? Like the most impractical things often are the things that we are most feel most sure about.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. It's those sparks, I guess, that keep us coming back. If everything in life was predictable and we did it just because it made sense, it wouldn't be very interesting.
Yeah. You have talked about in previous interviews and elsewhere about how you sometimes feel like you're straddling two worlds. When you're writing, you think of yourself sometimes as a scientist, but when you're doing science, you think of yourself sometimes as a writer. Has that feeling of in between served you, or do you feel like it just leaves you continuing to feel unsettled?
Both. I think, yeah, it continues to leave me feeling unsettled, but I think it's that sense of uncertainty and being uncomfortable where we grow and learn the most. So yeah, those in-between spaces is where I've always really been drawn intellectually and personally. It doesn't always mean that I know what I'm doing there, but even back in my undergraduate, I had a degree in gender studies and a degree in ecology, and those two worlds didn't always feel like they spoke to each other, but in a way they absolutely spoke to each other. And I think it's those conversations where, yeah, we have the most potential to grow individually, but also collectively to generate new ideas and to maybe think differently than we have in the past.
Yeah. So you're working on your new book right now. Tell us kind of where you are in that process. What's next? What sort of what not no pressure, but what sort of timeline are we looking at here?
Yeah, sure. Well, that is always an uncertainty. Taken as it comes, but I'm several chapters in. I have a the book is under contract with Viking Penguin Press, so that's exciting. And I have a deadline for the book to be at least in draft form by this coming fall. So I'm feeling, yeah, a little bit of pressure to keep things moving. But I also know that writing doesn't happen in the most linear fashion, that sometimes there's these incredible bursts of creativity. I've actually done a lot more research on this project than I maybe initially expected. I knew it would be science heavy, but I am having to learn a lot more, or at least I'm convincing myself I need to learn a lot more to be able to write about things in a more comprehensive way. So there's yeah, I've been digging into everything from sea sponge ecology to how tits have learned to steal milk from residents' porches to yeah, bowhead longevity to all sorts of things like that. So it's a kind of a combination of doing the research and then trying to merge that with the stories that are really driving the book.
And what do you hope that people take away from your writing and from this new book?
I hope that they take away the sense of possibility, and not sort of resilience in the really literal sense, but that there is an element of creativity and possibility in the natural world that I think really can echo into our own lives and perhaps help us think about a future that we all want to inhabit and not just the doomsday one that all of the sort of news media will have us believe is the only outcome.
Is there anything else that we didn't cover that you want our listeners to know? Anything you have coming up other than your new book that we should know about?
Too big. There's, I think this month there's an article in Alaska Magazine on sailing the Northwest Passage with kids. So
Okay.
that's one thing to check out. And hopefully there'll be some other short form work coming out in the next several months. But yeah, thanks so much for listening. And we'll hopefully be on the boat in May and experiencing new things and have more to report back on.
Perfect. I will make sure that there's a link to your website, which has links to all of your other, like all of the articles and all of the interviews that you've done for people if they want to find out more about you and your writing. That'll be in the notes for this show. So people will be able to check that out. And hopefully when your book comes out, we'll be able to get a copy and read it. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
been a real pleasure to talk.
Perfect. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
That's all for today's show. Thank you to my guest, Caroline Van Hemert. You can find more information about Caroline and her work at carolinevanhemert.com. You can find more information about our guests and this show on the Outdoor Explorer page at alaskapublic.org.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.